The way you think and what you think is, of course, tantamount to how elite athletes perform in competition. But what and how you think also dictates your mental health and overall wellness. And that's the subject covered by today's guest. This is the Thrive Podcast, the podcast that allows you to, well, thrive. Welcome to another edition of the Thrive Podcast, the podcast which helps professional high-performance athletes live a life of mental wellness, equilibrium, so to speak. And today we've got another great guest. He is Dr. Martin Turner. He's an award-winning researcher, practitioner, and known for his work in growing rational, emotive, behavioral therapy or theory within sport, I should say. Let me welcome him. It is with delight that we welcome him. Martin, I hope I can call you Martin.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, thank you for the invitation. Really good to be with you and really excited about the discussion we're going to have.
Martin, I think many of our listeners, they won't know exactly what REBT is. Can you help us get a better understanding?
Absolutely. Yeah, so RBT or Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy or theory kind of emanated in the 1950s, and it came out of an age where the dominant form of psychotherapy at that time was more of a Freudian approach, you know, a psychoanalysis and sort of psychodynamic theory. And this group of psychologists in the 50s and 60s started to develop techniques, therapies that were less based in Freudian theory and more based on the idea that the brain is an information processing machine, and therefore we can tinker with it. We can maybe talk to ourselves in ways that are more helpful for the things we want to do in life. We could restructure the thoughts that we're having about particular events in order to help us to function better in many aspects of our life. And RBT is developed at that time by somebody called Albert Ellis. And one of the things that Albert Ellis realized was that a lot of the time people are often generating their own emotional and behavioral issues, that they're in some ways contributing to their own suffering by the way that they think. And in particular, when they think things that aren't based in reality, when they think things that are, we would term it irrational, but basically things that are illogical and they don't really make sense and they're not really helping us. He understood that people were sometimes doing that to themselves for various reasons. So he figured out, if I can help these people to maybe reconstruct or challenge their irrational thought processes and maybe endorse and strengthen more rational thought processes, then they can actually meet their goals and be healthy and satisfied in life. So RBT is essentially helping people to first assess, get access to and reflect on their irrational beliefs, and then help them to deconstruct those beliefs or dispute those beliefs, and then start to work on developing and strengthening rational alternative beliefs. And in doing so, they can then start to experience emotions that are helpful to them, help them to pursue their goals and can alleviate quite a bit of suffering in the process. So that kind of, I guess, a snapshot.
Absolutely.
Can I ask you, Martin, I know that you have a self-report measure which tests, because this podcast is for professional and high-performance athletes, this measure tests an athlete's irrational performance beliefs. It's like an inventory. Can you elaborate and maybe outline the most common irrational performance beliefs a high performance athlete has and how you go about tackling to ensure, I guess, a greater mental well-being?
Absolutely, yeah. So, there's four main beliefs that we tend to see in human beings, that we would describe as irrational beliefs. This is something that Ellis noted. There's four things that people tend to tell themselves that aren't particularly helpful, and they all resonate really, really well with performers, with athletes, with coaches, with anybody operating in a performance environment. They resonate with. The first of them is demands. So it's not just that I want to succeed, it's that I have to and I must. It's that transference from the desire to do something, the desire to have something, to the demand that I must have it and I have to and I need to. That's an extremely common one within sport. And you could see that in the media, you know, how the media report on sporting moments. They talk about must wins and have to succeed and must not lose. We abuse that language. Language is important, you know. So when we abuse that language, when we use imprecise language, it means that people can often formulate imprecise thoughts and beliefs about their sport. So if I'm a young athlete who's interacting with the media, such as it is these days, and I see must win performances and must not lose and have to succeed, then I internalize those beliefs. And then I start to think that I have to succeed, whereas you don't have to succeed. You might want to. You might want to succeed really, really badly more than anything in the world, but you don't have to. You don't need to. There's no must that's relevant there. So the first belief that's highly relevant to athletes would be the must, the demand. Second one is what we call awfulizing. This is where you take something that has happened and you say that it's not just bad, it's awful, it's terrible, it's the end of the world. And again, if we look at media and how we talk within sport, within teams, within organizations, you would see language such as devastation and terrible performances and awful touches and, you know, devastating defeats. And again, it's imprecise, inaccurate language. Very, very rarely in life will you experience something that's truly awful. It will be bad, very bad. It might be the worst thing you've ever experienced. But the definition of awful is the worst thing that you can experience. And you can always think about things being worse. There is always something worse that you can experience, no matter what situation you're in. That's a tricky one for people to understand and get their heads around when they're in a bad situation, because it feels awful. But all the same, that belief doesn't tend to help people, doesn't tend to help them to come back from some of those bad moments. So we have demands, we have awfulizing. And the third one is frustration, intolerance. You are intolerant of setbacks, of pain, of suffering, of anything that might frustrate you in life, discomfort. You are intolerant. So you would hear this in language such as, I can't stand it. It's too much. I can't tolerate it. I can't bear it. When the reality is you can stand and tolerate almost anything. You know, the evidence of you tolerating it is your continued existence. There is a difference between can't stand and won't stand. You know, if you are in an environment that is quite toxic, and say you're being bullied by somebody within the sporting organization, you can choose not to tolerate that situation whilst also understanding that you can tolerate it. You have the capacity to tolerate, but you choose not to. So the third one is frustration, intolerance. I can't stand it. I can't bear it. I can't tolerate it. Then the fourth one, and this fourth one is particularly pernicious. It's particularly bad, this one. It's really not helpful. It's called global evaluation. And this is where you take the consequence of a single event and define your entire self, the entire world, or the entirety of another person. You define it on the basis of that one event. So if I fail, I'm a complete failure. If I'm treated badly, then I'm a worthless person. If that person does something bad to me, they are completely bad people. If I'm not earning as much as I want to, if I'm not succeeding as much as I want to, it shows that the world is bad. The world is evil. And this is particularly bad because it seems to be related quite highly to things like depression, things like, you know, certainly depressed mood, if not depression, anxiety, and a whole range of emotions. And one of the reasons it's so bad is because it's quite extreme. Because you're going to face lots of, as an athlete, you're going to face lots of failure. lots of pain. I think Thierry Henry once came out and said that he thinks he played one game without pain. So you are going to face suffering as an athlete. If you believe that suffering makes you completely weak, if you believe that failure makes you a complete failure, and you believe that if you do something wrong, it makes you a completely bad person, that's quite final, that's quite extreme, and that's difficult to hold that belief and stay psychologically healthy, because it's so negative and so extreme. So those are the four beliefs that are quite prevalent across human beings in general, but particularly in sport. We see a lot of this, particularly in the language people use around sport. Demands, awfulizing, frustration, intolerance, and global evaluation. Those are the keys.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting. I can recognize these beliefs in myself, but also with a lot of athletes that I work with. And I wonder, first of all, why do we have these irrational thoughts? Where do they come from? And then in the sporting context, can you give an example how we would work with those beliefs and turn them into something more helpful or more supportive to our career and to our well-being?
Yeah, absolutely. So your first question is a really good question. You know, where do these things come from? Why do we have them? There's no solid evidence as to why we might have these beliefs. I have my theories based on the things that I've read and the things that I've seen. One of the reasons is that we're born with the capacity to be irrational and rational. So we're born with that capacity. And then how we learn, social experiences, parenting, going to school, interactions with friends, the media, these systems and cultures that we operate within, then teach us this irrationality and at the same time teach us rationality. So it is within us to develop these beliefs, and it depends on the environments that we put ourselves in or the environments that we're born into. That's the aspect that really dictates the extent to which we become irrational and rational. Now, one of the arguments against the development of irrationality is, well, if it was completely useless, then we would have evolved to not be irrational. But actually, irrationality, if we think about our evolutionary past, could have been quite useful. It might make sense for me to demand that I capture something that I'm hunting, because it means that if I don't capture it, then people around me and myself might starve. If I'm trying to evade a predator, because we're prey animals, we were preyed upon in our evolutionary past, these extreme beliefs of awfulizing and intolerance and global evaluation and demands might have helped us in genuinely life-threatening situations where we did really need to escape or attack. So in our evolutionary past, these beliefs were probably quite useful. Now, evolution is a conservative process and it takes a long time. We're not just going to extinguish these beliefs all of a sudden because since the 50s, we've understood that these things aren't particularly helpful. It takes a long time to enact, species change in that sense. So where do these things come from? We have the capacity to develop irrational and rational beliefs. We are irrational in many, many ways as human beings. You know, it's with us. We have to learn to wrestle with it. I think it's partly because we have an evolutionary past where some irrationality might have aided us in our survival. In terms of then how we wrestle with that and work with that, we really try to teach people to be critical about the things that they think and believe about their sport. So say we have an athlete with a really deep belief that I want to succeed in this sport, and therefore I must, and therefore I have to. We would start to work with that athlete to understand, where is the evidence for the belief that you hold? Is it based on fact? Is there anything you could show me? Is there any law or rule, anything written down that suggests that this belief has some validity? Secondly, we ask questions about logic. Is it consistent with reality that just because you want something, you must have it? Is that how the world works? Is it logical? That's the second question. And thirdly, which is a really key question, and one that you don't just see in REBT, but one that you see in many, many therapies and psychological approaches to sport, is it helping you? is your current belief actually helping you on your journey to fulfill your potential as an athlete? And if the answer is no, then that's really the trigger for change. That's the point at which the individual says, okay, well, if it's not helping me, then I should probably abandon it. I should probably abandon the things that aren't helping me and maybe reinforce the things that are helping me. So that's the first step. We help the individual to deconstruct their beliefs. Where's the evidence for my belief? Is it logical? And is it helping me? Is it helpful for me to describe a bad event as terrible and awful and the worst thing in the world ever? Is it useful for me to describe it as the end of the world? Well, probably not. There's very little function. There's very little about that belief that's going to help you to move towards your goals. It might be more helpful to recognize, look, it's bad. I might need to make some adjustments, but it's not the end of the world. It's not terrible. It's not awful. It might be tough and difficult for me to tolerate the pain of this injury, but I can tolerate it. It's possible for me to stand this, and it's worth it for me to tolerate it because I've got an end goal in mind. So first step we do is deconstruction. Then we move to helping people develop more healthier beliefs. So if we take demands, we would, instead of saying, I want to and therefore I must, we would say, I want to, but I don't have to. I really want to win this tournament, but I don't have to win this tournament. This situation might be really bad, but it's not terrible. It's not awful. This situation is tough and difficult and painful, but I can tolerate it. I can stand it. And just because I've failed doesn't mean to sound a complete failure. Just because I have performed below expectations doesn't mean to say that I'm an idiot and I'm worthless. That your performance has nothing to do with your self-worth. You know, just because you perform badly, it doesn't detract from your value, your worth as a human being. They're two separate things, you know. So that's what we try to do, help athletes to construct more helpful. These helpful beliefs aren't positive. It's not that we're saying, just back yourself and think positively and you can do it. And it's more that these beliefs are based in reality. They're rational and logical and helpful. I wouldn't describe these things as positively toned. You know, these are just the truth. It's just the truth. Can you align your beliefs with reality? And if you can, then that's going to alleviate a lot of emotion when you're performing and a lot of suffering when you're performing, because you will suffer as a performer. It's difficult to be an athlete, isn't it? It's not an easy thing, or else everybody would do it. So I don't know if that answers your question. I think that the question around how do we help people, it's about helping them to reflect on their thoughts and beliefs, deconstruct them, and try to develop thoughts and beliefs that are based in reality, based in logic, and based in help. Is it helpful? Is it useful?
Just coming on to that, maybe on another level, Martin, we talk, and athletes would probably revolve their life around their athletic career, training, competition. And yes, they would probably say that everything is geared towards that. But what about their innate wellness, well-being, mental health? If they, correct me if I'm wrong, if they can deal with that maybe as the foundation and be happier without the external athletic career, then perhaps they could perform better on the field as well. How do you sort of balance that out, and how would you advise an athlete to become a more contented, a more calm, anxiety-free person and then athlete?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think one of the biggest pieces of advice that I can offer athletes around that is to make sure that you don't define your life or make your life completely about your sport. And that goes for anybody doing any occupation. Don't make your life about your occupation. You have many parts of your life, relationships, vocations, hobbies. If you define your life completely by one of those things, it means that your identity is in a precarious position. What I mean by that is, if I define myself completely as an athlete and I don't succeed as much as I would like to as an athlete, then it puts into question my identity. If I completely define myself as an athlete and I have to retire early because maybe of a career-ending injury, I then have a complete crash, an identity crisis. Who am I? If I'm not performing, then who am I? So one of the things I would work with athletes on is, how big a range do you have in your identity? You know, what other things are you doing? What other things are you connected to that mean that you can define yourself more globally? You know, it's not just an athlete, but I'm a human being that competes in sport. I'm a human being that does football, does athletics, does tennis. It's something you do. It's not something you are. And this is really because we're quite sloppy as human beings in the way that we use language. We would describe ourselves as things. I am a golfer. I am an academic. Your entirety is not defined by that one thing. There are things you do and there's things you don't do. There's only one thing you are, and that's a human being. So once you can teach athletes about that humanness, you are a human being that does things, then it frees them up. It means that there's less pressure when they go into tournaments because they're not seeing this, their entire life on the line. You know, their entire identity on the line, on the penalty spot. They can stop seeing it in that way and realize, look, this is part of who I am. It's something I do. Sometimes it goes well. Sometimes it goes badly. Hopefully it goes well more than it goes badly. That's what I can hope for. That's what I can work towards. But my full identity, my full self is never on the line because I'm a complicated human being with lots of aspects that make me who I am. I think that when athletes can, and you would see this in athletes that retire, if you read interviews and reports, they would say, you know, it's more balanced for me now. You often see this when athletes have children and they say, it put everything in perspective for me. It made me realize that when I fail, it's not the end of the world and sport isn't all that's there for me. There's this life outside of sport that is actually more important. So is pressure me taking a penalty from the spot? No. Pressure is having a sick child, you know? So it redefines and they gain perspective by having different life experiences. So don't make your entire life about sport. That's a really precarious position to put yourself in.
Yeah, I was going to say that, I don't know, you tell me how easy that is before they have a kid or before they have some sort of external type of interest that can take their mind away from their competition. I don't know how hard or easy that is. Maybe you can elaborate. But the other question I wanted to ask you is this notion that I think you talk about, which is being able to self-regulate for pressure situations. Can you elaborate and explain how an athlete does that?
Yes. Yeah, so to your first point, you know, when I suppose when life is, maybe it's less complicated when you're younger, I don't know, but maybe you've got less aspects to you. Maybe, you know, you've got school, friends, your parents, your family, and then you've got your sport. And there is a danger that as parents, that we encourage children to only focus on one thing, on one sport, and do that all the time at the cost of friends and family. And in some of the sports that I've supported, certainly athletes have not been to brothers and sisters' weddings, have not been to christenings, have not been to grandparents' birthdays because they're performing, because they're training, you know? So they're making sacrifices. They're constantly sacrificing, you know, this other self, you know, for the athlete self. And that's something that young athletes have to be really mindful of. You have to be sure that it's worth it, not financially, but it's worth it as a human being to give everything that you are over to sport and to sacrifice all of these other aspects. You have to be really, really sure it's worth it. And I'm not sure if a young person is really able to make that decision. I mean, the sport that I've been involved in most is football, and that is an industry that encourages athletes to get involved at a young age. You know, a club can bring somebody on at age 9. And it starts to set their identity quite early as a footballer. And I can only think that is dangerous for the individual's well-being, but it might be helpful for their performance. it might be helpful for their performance because it means they're motivated towards one thing. They've made sacrifices, which means that they're able to dedicate time and resources to this one thing. So maybe it does help their performance. But I think they pay for it with their well-being and their mental health. When you close off every other part of your life and only have one part of your life, it means that when that part of your life that you completely focus on doesn't go well, which it won't, because you will be injured, you will be ill, you will fail, you will get dropped from the team from time to time. When it doesn't go well, it's a crisis, it's a catastrophe. It's not just a bad situation, because everything that I am is wrapped up in this thing. So yeah, I think it is more challenging for young athletes. And what we need to do is give them appropriate guidance. And that comes from, it comes from teachers, it comes from parents, it comes from coaches. It comes from, you know, the sports scientists and sports psychologists that are working within those clubs, which up and down the country are doing fantastic work at academy level to help to get this philosophy into kids. So I think it starts from there. Your second question was about self-regulation. I think when somebody's in a pressure situation, when they're in a moment where they are having to regulate very many complex things, thoughts, their behavior, their emotions, their physiology, as well as execute something really refined, you know, a skilled performance, then I think the question is, what state do you want to be in order for you to execute that performance as best as you possibly can? And that desire to be in that state should be informed by what states have you been in the past that have helped you to perform, and what states have you been in the past that have not helped you to perform? And can we increase the likelihood that we get you into the state that helps you to perform well? Once we've made that decision, then we can think about how to regulate all of those components in service of that state. So when I say state, what I mean is the athlete might say, well, you know what, actually, I've recognized that when I'm under pressure, I seem to perform better when I'm more relaxed. When I feel more relaxed, well, okay, then we can do some psychological skills training. We can have some conversations. We can develop some techniques that get you to be more relaxed. For example, at the penalty spot, that might involve some rhythmic breathing. It might involve, stuff that comes from the mind first and then goes to the body. It might involve some relaxing thoughts. It might involve a conversation with yourself that, okay, this is an important moment, but it's not the end of the world if things don't go well. Okay, this is really important for the team, but this doesn't define who I am. This is just a moment in my life. So they can talk to themselves in a way that has the knock-on effect of relaxing the body, you know? And then behaviorally, you know, what can they do from a behavior perspective to get an edge on their performance? Well, you can act assertively, you can behave self-confidently, you can, you know, embody what it is to be a confident, assertive performer. You can enact those behaviors, and quite often the mind and body will follow that behavioral kind of intention, how you intend to act. So it really comes, you know, from my perspective in the work that I do, it really comes from these thoughts, behaviors, and emotions, and how can we get into the states that are most helpful for our performance. Another performer might say, actually, no, for me, it's not about being relaxed. It's about being really, really pumped and really high energy. Okay, well, how do we help that individual to get into that state by regulating thoughts, emotions, and behaviors? So, and that, for that individual, it might be completely different to the first athlete we talked about. They might think, behave, emote completely different ways. It's really... Self-regulation comes from a place of where do you want to be and how do we then help you to regulate those three aspects, those thoughts, behaviors, emotions, to get you to that state. There's no correct state for a performer to be in. I can't tell a performer, okay, before you're doing this action, this is how you should feel, because everybody, you know, feels differently. We're so idiosyncratic as human beings. I can't tell an athlete what the best state to be in. All I can do is help them to understand what their most facilitative state is and then help them to get to that state by controlling thoughts, behaviors, and emotions. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, for sure. I think Alan wanted to ask you one, but I was just keen to perhaps get some more tips on how you can self-regulate, how you can deal with anxieties and stresses. Obviously, everybody's different, but I guess it's about rationalizing those thoughts. Do you have to practice these things on a daily basis for a certain amount of time? And so what tips would you give?
This is really about depth. So the ideal position for a performer to be in would be that they go into those pressure situations without having to consciously self-regulate. They have this deep philosophy that is, there's things I want that I don't have to have. It's not terrible when I fail. You know, they have this rational, balanced perspective of life. Now, you take an individual with that balanced perspective who is very deeply rational, put them in a pressure situation, then it's going to take less effort for them to self-regulate because they're just naturally balanced because they've sorted out their philosophy of performance. They've gone into the performance environment and said, okay, well, you know, this isn't everything that I am. I'm a complex human being. If things don't go well, then it's not the end of the world. It doesn't mean I'm a complete failure. Let's try and have a good game. They've got that philosophy sorted. So when they face pressure moments, they don't necessarily need to do as much self-regulation. Does that make sense?
Mm.
But for those that are trying to develop that philosophy, yeah, in the first instance, it'd be daily practicing these thoughts. It'd be creating little cue cards to put around your apartment or house or wherever you live. Your little cue cards with rational statements on it. It'd be little folded up pieces of paper in your wallet or purse or your kit bag. It'd be creating messages for yourself in spaces you can see them. You're trying to rehearse consciously, but also expose yourself to messages that are going to be helpful. And you can do that by creating that environment for yourself. So that's part of it. And then over time, that stuff starts to become ingrained and embedded and starts to achieve more depth. As the more you rehearse it, the more you start to be able to remember these things and start to use them in performance. So you might use some of these self statements before you undertake something pressured. You might say, okay, really important penalty. I'm going to tell myself, I want to succeed, but I don't have to. It's not the end of the world if things don't fail, but here's where I'm going to put the penalty. So you use this self-talk in a way that reduces the pressure, but also is instructive as to what you're actually going to achieve in that skill execution. Where am I going to put the ball? You know, which is the fundamental aspect of it. So you can introduce that into your performance environment and use that as like a self-statement and as a self-talk. But I think that a better place to come from is that you have this deep rational philosophy that you take into all performance situations that means that you don't need to do as much of that self-regulation, you know? Now, for athletes who are not there yet, because we're all on that journey in some ways to be more rational as a human species, you know, science is progressing all the time. We're all on that journey to try to exercise this rationality. And, you know, athletes that I might be working with are on that journey too, and they're trying to figure out how to include this rationality in their performance. So at any stage of the journey, it still might be relevant to do some self-regulation when you're undertaking a pressure moment. And that can include self-talk, as we've discussed there. It can include visualization and imagery. If we take the penalty example, not only can I choose a spot of where to put it, can I visualize myself executing that skill perfectly? And different sports, different individuals require different types of imagery. It might be that my imagery is me taking myself to a calm, relaxing place in order for me to relax in any given moment. It might be that my imagery relates to a specific skill that I want to execute. So we can use imagery to up and down regulate our emotions. I can use imagery to make myself angry if I'm in combat sports and that might be useful for me to increase my aggression, for me to get a bit angry so I can imagine and visualize things that might set me off to put me in the right state for performance in the ring. So we can use imagery, self-talk. You know, using the body is also a key component as well. Like I mentioned breathing before, you know, using rhythmic breathing in order to relax and calm down and get a bit of balance is obviously something quite key. One of the things that you'll see from, say, a rugby kickers is they'll have a routine. They'll do something specific every time before they execute that skill. You would see this in tennis as well with the tennis serve. Maybe they bounce the ball a number of times, or they adjust something in their kit every time before they serve. They have this behavioral routine that they try to control everything they possibly can in order to achieve some kind of performance consistency. And that includes controlling their behavior, having a routine. You know, so there's lots and lots of things people can do, and there's no one formula. And like I said before, really, it's all about how do you get into the state that you know will aid your performance. Loads of options: self-talk, imagery, relaxation, using the body, breathing, having a routine that gets you where you need to be. But I think at the core of it, it's having a core philosophy, a core set of beliefs that really frees you up when you perform and allows you to express yourself by understanding that this isn't life or death. It's not the end of the world when I'm performing sport if it doesn't go well. And if it does go well, it doesn't mean I'm a superhero. It doesn't mean I'm a success. It just means I've done something well, and that's a good thing. So reduce that pressure by adopting those core philosophies, I think, is the real key. But there's loads of techniques people can use when going into performances that can aid their performance.
Awesome. Martin, so I really understand like the philosophical shift that ideally players can go through to really change their relationship to their beliefs and to their results. And yet I've spoken to many athletes and they visibly get this, but then they face like a match situation, like a penalty free kick or a tie break. And in these moments, they get extremely tight. And then when they, so to say, mess things up, they get depressed and anxious and they fall into this terrible cycle of underperforming and then feeling terrible about it.
Yeah.
So can you give an example of an athlete? He has this belief about demands, like I have to win this no matter what. He philosophically gets that this belief isn't helpful, and yet he needs a tool in performing situations, whether it's affirmations or something to work with. Like,
yeah,
what would you tell him?
Well, I think there's two things there. One of the reasons that happens is because the athlete hasn't trained under sufficient pressure whilst practicing these philosophies. So one of the things that you would see is an individual, as you kind of intimated there, they would intellectually, philosophically understand these beliefs. But when the going gets tough, those things go out the window and they go back to their old beliefs. That's because under pressure, we tend to go back to default. We tend to revert to what is instinctual to us and what feels natural. So there's lots of things going on there. The belief hasn't been rehearsed enough. It was never truly believed at a really deep level. It was only being repeated. It was only being parroted. Second thing is that belief hasn't been tested and trained under pressure. It's okay for me to sit in my, to lie in bed at the end of a training day and repeat these beliefs to myself because it's easy. I'm relaxed. There's nothing challenging me. I'm not emotionally high. So that's easy for me to do. How have you trained these beliefs under pressure? How tough is your practice in terms of psychological pressure? When you go into competitions, are you using these beliefs at key moments? Are you really trying to challenge yourself to do that? Because if you're not doing that, then it makes it more likely that when you do face pressure, the old beliefs are going to come back. So I think the first thing is to practice under pressure, try to recreate the actual performance environment as much as you can, bearing in mind that you'll never make a practice environment as pressured as a competition, but you can still go some way to make it pressured. And when it is pressured, to practice these beliefs under those pressured circumstances, to, in your imagery and visualization, to put yourself in your mind in difficult situations. Don't just visualize playing perfect shots. Don't just visualize the perfect performance. Visualize difficult situations and see yourself managing those situations with rationality. See yourself using these beliefs and staying on top of it and staying calm under pressure. So I think it comes from that performance preparation in and around practice and training, you know, mental training and physical training too. In the moment, really the three questions that we've talked about is really, really useful for athletes in the moment. Say you're on a break between games in tennis and you're sitting in the chair next to the umpire. You've got all these thoughts running through your head. You can ask yourself, is it true? Is it logical? Is it useful? If it doesn't meet that criteria, then I need to be thinking something different. If this thought that I'm having isn't helping me, if it's not logical, if it's not true, if it's based on some fantasy that I must win everything and that it's terrible when I don't win, if it's based on that kind of fantasy, then, okay, there's something else I can think here. So I think it's stimulated by those three questions, and that takes the individual. It means taking a break, you know, mentally from what's, you know, from what's going on in that situation, and stepping back and assessing their own thoughts and saying, let me step back and ask myself, is it true? Is it logical? Is it consistent with reality? Is it helping me? Okay, no, it's not helping me. No, it's not true. No, it's not logical. Okay, what might be more helpful? And it might be a rational thought. It might be, I really want this, but I don't have to succeed. It might be, it's really, really difficult, but I can tolerate it. Or it might just be something instructive. Focus on the next point, next point, next point, next point. You know, it might be really instructive, but fundamentally what we're trying to do is shift the athlete's thoughts from stuff that's not helping them. You know, oh, this is going terribly. It's going really bad. It's really embarrassing. My family are in the crowd. And we're taking it from that to something that is more functional, something that is based on something they can control, which is my approach to the next point. Particularly if I'm serving, even if I'm not serving, I can still control my placement, where I stand up, and control my body language and my behavior. You know, we talk about that a lot in sports psychology, control the controllables. And that is a popular idea, and probably over the past 10 or 15 years, it was abused a little bit to mean, let me control everything that I possibly can in my performance environment. So we have this rise of something called marginal gains, which was, you know, can I control the tiny little bits and pieces of performance? You know, that can take things too far. But fundamentally, you're trying to get the individual to focus on aspects of their performance that are directly under their control. You know, and why that's important is because very little of your performance is under your control. You are reacting to an opponent quite often. You are reacting to the conditions. You are subject to umpire decisions, referee decisions. So there are lots of things you can't control. You certainly can't control other people's expectations of you, or what they think about you, or how the media report on your performance. You certainly can't control that. What can you control? I can control what I think in the moment. I can control, or I can try to control, how I approach this next point. I'm going to approach it positively, rationally. I'm going to manage my behavior so I look assertive, I look ready at each point. I'm going to manage and control my emotions. I'm going to make sure that I keep anxiety at bay by telling myself the things I need to tell myself to manage that anxiety. So, you know, this idea of control becomes really, really important in those moments where we're trying to help people to deliver, particularly under pressure conditions, but under any condition, really, even if it's a relatively simple skill, we can still be practicing and utilizing these kind of psychological skills and techniques.
Martin, last question. So we talked about deconstructing unhelpful beliefs. You alluded to introducing more helpful beliefs. How do we plant more helpful beliefs into our consciousness? Do we use affirmations, or are there any other tools that you recommend athletes to use?
Yeah, affirmations are definitely useful. You have to, when you've developed some affirmations that are more rational. So say, for example, you have some affirmations that say, sometimes performance situations will be tough, but I can tolerate them and it's worth it for me to tolerate. That is a good rational statement. It's true, it's logical, it makes sense, it's probably going to be useful. Okay, say you've got that as an affirmation. It's not enough to just casually interact with that affirmation, to just read it every now and again. You have to say it to yourself with intent. You have to really focus on the right words. Yes, it's sometimes performance is tough, but I can tolerate it. I can stand this, and it is worth it to do so. You have to say this in an impassioned way that means something and is meaningful to the brain. It can't just be just reading self-statements as if they're going to be absorbed in some fashion. So I think affirmations are super useful. What you would want to do is go from affirmation to this deep philosophical shift. So affirmations are useful in the journey to deep philosophical shift. Ideally, what you'd want as an athlete is to truly understand and believe that I can tolerate suffering. I can tolerate tough situations and failure and pain. I genuinely can. The evidence is in front of me. It's logical and it's useful, you know, to really believe that, rather than just repeat affirmations that have been designed because they should help me. You start with affirmations. You repeat and rehearse in lots of different situations, under pressure, outside of pressure, in lots of different circumstances and scenarios. You really, really try to ingrain this stuff and practice and rehearse it. You visualize yourself in difficult situations using this affirmation, using this belief. Then over time, it sinks in. You know, some of the athletes I would work with will have had this belief for 10, 20, 30 years. They would have had this irrationality at the core that has been causing them issues for so long. They choose to address it now because it's come to a point where they can't move on and pursue their goals, or they're really starting to suffer because of that belief. But they've believed this for a long time. There's no way we're going to be able to deconstruct that belief and help them to develop a new belief in a short amount of time. We might be able to end our work with them having this new belief to use, but then they've got to really commit to it over a long period of time, you know? And what we don't want to happen is for the individual to go into a performance constantly having a mental battle between irrationality and rationality, because that's exhausting. Self-regulation is exhausting. You know, it takes up this finite resource that we've got of you know, energy. So we want to save that energy for our actual performance. We don't want to be having those internal battles. What you want to do is have those internal battles away from the performance environment. Do those battles in training. Do those battles when you're doing mental rehearsal and your mental and physical training, so that when you go into performance, you can just free your mind to be as rational as it can be, to be as functional as it can be. That takes a lot of rehearsal, a lot of practice, a lot of ingraining this stuff at a deep level. Otherwise, you end up going into performance with you know, the angel and the devil on the shoulder, constantly having this battle. And that's distracting. It's exhausting. And who knows which one's going to win? Sometimes the devil will win. Sometimes the angel will win. It's much better to go into that performance just with the angel. You know, it takes practice and rehearsal and commitment. Like anything in sport does, it's no different, is it? If I want to get a perfect first serve, I'm going to need to practice and practice and practice and practice under loads of different scenarios. It's the same with these mental skills. You've got to practice them under as many scenarios as you can. And then they'll become, you know, more cemented, and it will fortify you against the pressures of performance, you know, to a much greater capacity.
Martin, you've been absolutely fascinating. Some great tips, and I'm sure it's going to be extremely valuable to our audience. Where do people learn more about your work and so forth?
You know, the best place for people to go would probably be Smarter Thinking Profile. You referenced this earlier. They can complete a free online survey about their beliefs, and then they'll get a free kind of downloadable report which tells them what beliefs they have and maybe some ways forward. So Smarter Thinking Profile, you can find information about some of the other bits and pieces that we do there. But also, we have a free smartphone app which is called Smarter Thinking. And that basically helps people to deconstruct some of these beliefs and to develop more helpful, more rational beliefs. And again, that's a free app that people can use. So in combination, that's probably a good place for people to start. You know, go and do the profile, see what the results say, then have a look at the app and have a go at deconstructing and working with your beliefs and see how you can, you know, integrate some of that stuff into your training, into your performance.
Well, awesome. Listen, I'm going to try it myself, actually, Martin. I'm not a high performance athlete, far from, but I'm going to download the app as soon as I get off this call to you. And I want to thank you on behalf of myself, I'm sure Alon as well, and all our audience, because this has been fascinating and I'm sure extremely useful to everybody. Thank you so much for your time.
Do head over to the Thrive website. That's www.thrive, spelt THR, the digit one, VE.space, where you can sign up for further giveaways and, of course, tips. That's www.thrive, spelt THR, one, VE.space. After all, this is your space to thrive.